Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to take up the story of Samson. We're going to start in chapter 13. He's going to run for several chapters, chapter 14, chapter 15, maybe even 16. I haven't looked that far ahead. In this particular chapter, we're going to look at Samson's marriage, 20 verses, the whole chapter. The last chapter, our context, is Samson's birth, which is chapter 13. He's our last judge, judge number 12. So we start now in Judges 14, verses 1 through 3. Then Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and told his father and mother, "I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife." Then his father and his mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives, or among all our people, that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she looks good to me." Little minor point to start out with. Samson went down to Timnah. Judah, one of the patriarchs, is said to go up to Timnah. How do you explain that? John Gill says, well, maybe it's two different places, or maybe one's coming from above and one's coming from below, from different sides. It doesn't matter. But where is this Timnah? Well, if we'll look at a map, if you'll find the Valley of Ajalon, we'll maybe find Jerusalem. Go 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem, you've got Gibeon. Go about 7 or 8 miles west of Gibeon, you're in Ajalon, where Joshua commanded the sun and the moon to stand still. And then go south about 5 miles, you're at Eshtaol, where Samson died, and also where he grew up and exhibited his great powers. You go a little bit south of Eshtaol, and you hit Zorah. That's where Samson was born. Now, if you're at Zorah, you're in the Valley of Sorek, through which the Sorek River travels, that long river that empties out into the Mediterranean Sea about 7 or 8 miles south of Joppa. Well, if you go up the Sorek Valley, up the Sorek River from Zorah, Samson's birthplace, you're talking about maybe 5 miles or so. You are at a place called Timnah. Timnah was headed toward Philistine territory. In fact, it was about 3 or 4 miles east of Ekron, the famous Philistine city, one of the five Philistine cities. So he's in the Philistine territory here, and he saw a Philistine woman and said, "Oh, she's hot. I want her." Now, Timnah was a frontier town of the Philistines. It originally had belonged to Judah, and afterwards Judah gave it to Dan. We'll read about that. We can read about that in Judges 19 when we get there. But the Philistines had gotten it despite the fact that it had been allocated by the Israelites to Judah and Dan. The tribes of Judah and the tribes of Dan, but now the Philistines have got it, but now David took it back from the Philistines. But then, later on, in the period of the monarchy, during the times of King Ahaz, the Philistines got it back, as we see in 2 Chronicles 28. So, Timnah is going back and forth between the Israelites and the Philistines throughout history. The name Timnah means a portion. It was about 20 miles west of Jerusalem. About Jameson Fawcett Brown says it's about 3 miles from Zorah. I said it was about 5 miles, I was estimating. Somewhere between 3 and 5 miles up the Sorek River. Now he saw this woman, and it was love at first sight. Well, this love at first sight didn't work out too well. I'm sorry for all of you who like to watch all these romantic chick flicks. Love at first sight is usually a disaster. I had an unfortunate circumstance for me in high school, and I ended up almost ruining my life because one look, bang, switch turns on, the chemistry starts to flow, the chemicals start running into your brain and shutting your brain down where it doesn't work anymore. And Samson's brain was not working here. His father and mother in verse 2, their brains were working, and they were saying, why don't you find a circumcised Hebrew instead of an uncircumcised Philistine? Of course, the circumcision doesn't mean anything except it was a symbol of people who worshiped Yahweh and people who didn't. We don't want to get the symbol mixed up for the reality here as to what was important. Now, one commentator said that Samson did good to try to get his parents' approval, but let's face it, you can't do anything back then without your parents' approval, so I'm not sure whether he did good so much. I don't think he was acting above and beyond the call of duty. I think he just had to do what he had to do. I'm not too impressed with Samson's moral character, as we'll see, and I'll show you why as we go through here. Now, Samson, to his credit, didn't try to sugarcoat it with his parents. He just said, "She's a Philistine, I want her." Didn't bother him a bit, and I suspect that's because he had no sense of the unique place that the elect Jews had in God's redemptive plan. He told his father to go get the girl, and that what he means by that is go handle all the negotiations, because of course marriages were negotiated by parents back then. Now, was Samson violating the law of Moses, the law of God, when he wanted to marry an uncircumcised Philistine? Well, actually, you could make a case that he was not violating the law. As John Gill points out, the law forbade marriage to one of the seven Canaanite nations, and the Philistines weren't one of those seven. So the objection that you can make against Samson is that he was marrying into an idolatrous nation, not that he was explicitly violating the law. That's John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown's take. Adam Clark says, no, it was against the law. If you look at Exodus 34:16, the law says this, you might take some of his, that referring to an inhabitant of the land, you may take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might play the harlot with their gods and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods. And this is a no-no, of course. Well, who does this inhabitant of the land refer to? If we go back in Exodus 34, back up from verse 16 to verse 11, and we'll see the seven nations. But be sure to observe what I'm commanding you this day. Behold, I'm going to drive out the Amorite and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. No direct reference to the Philistines. However, we know that the law is case law. The judges have to reason from the case examples that are given in the law and the code and applied to different circumstances because there's a trillion different circumstances that can happen, but there's only so many codes or so many statutes, so many laws that you can put in a statute book. And so I suspect that enumeration of the seven tribes of the Canaanites is just an enumeration of examples of the general principles. Don't marry the pagans because they'll make you play harlot with their gods. So yeah, he was against the law. I'm sorry, John Gill, I don't agree with you there. Samson was violating the law. What did he care? Now in verse 3, Samson said to his father, get her for me. He didn't mention his mother. Now some people have speculated that because the mother was so vehemently against the marriage that he decided to go to a weak-willed father to let him do it. But it could be also that that's who handled negotiations, not the mother. The father did. So that's why he's talking to the father. Go get her for me. Now note the father's actions. He didn't refuse Samson. He should have said, no, Samson, I'm not going to get the Philistine daughter for you because it will ruin your life. Application point. You got a son that wants to marry a girl and he doesn't have any money, doesn't have a job. The father should say, look, son, she's a sweet girl, but I'm not going to go to your wedding. I'm not going to support your wedding because you don't have a job. I mean, let's face it. Marriage is an economic institution. It's a business arrangement. Forget all this romance stuff. You can't support a wife and you can't support the children, well, then you got no business marrying him. And likewise, let's say that your son wants to marry a pagan. I'm sorry. I'm not going to support that marriage. Now, that might be hard to do, but look at the results. When you don't do it, when you don't put your foot down, when you see a bad marriage amongst your offspring. Now, this is one of my favorite situations here, verse 3. Samson said, get her for me. Why? Because she looks good to me. She looks good. Samson is basing his lifelong chances for marital bliss on the way the woman looks. Now, of course, this is a notable weakness of the male sex. Happens all the time. And it's something that every man ought to watch out for with every fiber of his being. You make a marriage based on looks. You don't take time spending on a relationship. You end up in trouble. I'm going to tell you two stories here. One is my homeroom in high school. I mean, I had the prettiest girls in high school in my homeroom. They were all there. And I went to high school reunions, 20, 30, 40, 50, 50-year reunions. And I'm telling you, those pretty girls, beaten, divorced, miserable, and ugly. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them just looked awful because life had treated them hard. Because boys never approach them as a human being, just as a sex object. Oh, they're pretty. That's the first story. Second story is a story that occurred when I was teaching in China and I was riding a bus with a fellow professor and he was telling me about all the problems he was having with his ex-wife. He had paid for their son's college education and she had unenrolled the son and enrolled him at another college, pocketed the money with the refund money, and then she said, our divorce agreement says you've got to pay for his education. He said, I already did. She said, no, we dropped out of that school. You need to pay for the new school. And so he has to go to court. And he said, that's not the first time. He said he's been spending his life in court with this crazy woman. And so I asked the logical question, why did you marry her? And he quickly responded, because she was beautiful. Whew. He said, I was young and stupid. He was not young and stupid anymore, but it was too late. Let me sum up Samson's three errors here. in the first three verses first. He relied on lust rather than common sense. She's a Philistine, Samson. Stay away. I don't care how pretty she is. Number two, he didn't care about spiritual matters, even if it was technically legal to marry a Philistine, which I don't believe it was. But even if it were legal, it wasn't a godly thing to do. It was a stupid thing to do. It was not a spiritual thing to do. And the third thing that Samson didn't do, he didn't listen to his parents, who had a lot more wisdom than he had. We go now to Judges chapter 14, verse 4. However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion. That's the Lord was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. So Samson was directed by God, but I just finished saying that what he did was stupid and terrible. Well, how could God direct somebody to do something stupid and terrible? Well, that's because God can take the stupid actions of us humans and turn it around to accomplish his purpose. He does that all the time. All the time. Now we can ask a question here. Did Samson consciously know that he was doing God's will by marrying this Philistine woman? I doubt it. Seriously, John Gill says he consciously knew that he was doing God's will. I don't believe that. The argument goes, those who say that Samson knew he was doing God's will is he wasn't really attracted merely by or directed to marry that woman because of her physical attraction. Why? Because she had a younger sister that was prettier. And if Samson was only attracted by looks, he would have wanted the younger sister. How do we know the younger sister was prettier? Well, we read in the next chapter, Judges 15:2, her father said, that's Samson's wife at Timnah, her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. This is after the story we're going to see in a minute blew up, the marriage blew up, and Samson lost his first Philistine wife, and so her father gave her to your companion. That means probably the friend of the bridegroom at the marriage. And then the father of the woman says, is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Well, and so the argument is Samson wasn't going just by looks. He passed up the prettier girl for the one that's not as pretty, even though she was pretty. Well, all I got to say about that is the father may have been exaggerating to make his point. He's trying to justify having given away Samson's wife. He's in a bad situation. He says, look, hey, man, you could have had a younger sister. She's more beautiful. And that just might have been in his eyes, not Samson's eyes. I don't believe he thought he was doing God's will. He wanted that woman. He didn't care about God's will. He was not a spiritual man at this point. Now, let me repeat, how could God take this ungodly marriage and use it? Well, because he often takes sinful actions and turns them around to good, as in Romans 8:28. Now, you could say it wasn't sinful because it wasn't unlawful, because Philistines weren't mentioned in that list of seven nations that the Israelites were not supposed to marry. But I've already said I don't believe that for a minute. I think it was sinful for him to marry the woman. And God takes the sinful actions and judged the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel, verse 4 says. And that means, of course, that Israel was in abject submission and they needed a deliverer. So we go now to Judges 14, verses 5 through 7. Then Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, and came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, upon Samson, not the lion, came upon Samson mightily, so that he tore the lion as one tears a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. So he went down and talked to the woman, that's the woman at Timnah, the Philistine woman, and she looked good to Samson. Huh? She's looking, still looking good. There's that phrase again. Now the father and mother went to Timnah with Samson. Why did they go? Perhaps they saw that Samson was so determined it was useless to resist, although back then parents had a lot of power over the children. So maybe it was this. Samuel had told them that this was of God, and his parents believed him. I don't think Samson thought that this was of God, and I don't think he tried to hoodoo his parents into thinking it was of God. I think his parents were weak and said, well, our strapping son here, he wants this woman. We're going to make him happy and let him get her. Well, just as Samson and his father and mother were just about to get to Timnah, they got to the vineyards outside of Timnah. Wine is often mentioned in the scriptures being made in Philistia, which remembers the Shephelah region, the southwest part of Israel along the Mediterranean coast. Lots of vineyards down there. So the young lion comes out. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson. Interesting, this ungodly man had the Spirit of the Lord come upon him so that he could kill that lion. It just shows God will take God will take nasty people and work his purposes out. Now, why did Samson not tell his mother? Obviously, this was not done in their presence. Why did he not tell his parents that he had killed that lion. Well, it could be, because just because he was modest, didn't think any big deal about it. But I think more probably is he didn't want to put the Philistines on guard by revealing his great strength prematurely. He was afraid his parents might spill the beans to the Philistines, and so he wanted to go undercover just for a little bit longer. It's really hard to say why he didn't tell, but those are the two options I can think of. Verse 7, Samson goes down to Timnah from the killing the lion, and he talked to the woman, and she looked good still. So talking to her, he got to know more than just her physical beauty, but the physical beauty is what caught him. And by the way, I'm not against physical beauty. Of course, women should look good to the men that are chasing them to get married. Of course they should. It's just that that's not the sole criterion. What was he talking about when he was talking to this woman? Probably about the marriage arrangements. We go down to Judges chapter 14, verses 8 through 13. When he returned later to take her. Now, what that means is he had gone back to Zorah, his hometown. I'm not sure whether he's moved from Zorah to Eshtaol or not. I'm not sure, but they're very close to each other. So he went back home, basically, gave the wife time to get ready, time to make all the arrangements, and then he came back to Timnah, back from his hometown, to take her. How long did this take? At least one commentator says it was over a year before Samson came back. Judging by the state of the lion's carcass when he found his lion that he had killed, it had completely dried up. All the flesh had putrefied and disappeared, as that's what happens when dead bodies lie out in the sun long enough. They turn into bones. You've seen enough westerns to see the dead cattle in the desert sand. That was necessary because bees would be naturally averse to rotting flesh, but dried bones are no problems. No problem of bees could make a nest in dried bones. And so, according to one commentator, take a year for that. I'm not sure it takes a year for a corpse to dry up. I'm not a naturalist, so I don't know. But at any rate, it was a good bit of time. The woman had to have time to prepare herself. So he comes back, and in verse 9, he scraped the honey that was in those bones of that lion into his hand, and he ate it. Came to his father and mother, gave them some honey to eat, but he didn't tell them he had scraped the honey out of the body of the lamb. Now, was it against the law for Nazarites? Remember, Samson's under a Nazarite law, a Nazarite vow, perpetual vow for the rest of his life. He's touching a dead body, a dead lion. Now, the law of the Nazarite vow is found in Numbers chapter 6. And we can read in Numbers 6, verse 6, that a Nazarite was not even supposed to go near a dead body, much less touch it. Let me read that. Number 6:6. He, the Nazarite, must not go near a dead body during the time he consecrates himself to the Lord. Well, he went next to a dead body, the lion. Now, some people try to let Samson off the hook here and say he didn't really violate the Nazarite vow because the Nazarite vow, the law, only contemplated going near a dead human body. But Samson went next to a dead animal body, and that's okay. So we read number 6:7. He, the Nazarite, is not to defile himself for his father or mother or his brother or sister. Those are all human beings. The Nazarite's not supposed to defile himself for those family members when they die. No dead animals are mentioned, just dead family members. Well, again, the law can easily be extended, and one can make extrapolations from the law very easily. And so it's a reasonable extrapolation to say that the law prohibited touching dead animals as well as dead humans. So, in my humble opinion, Samson has broken his Nazarite vow. Again, he's not the most spiritual guy in the world. Now, why did he not tell his parents where that honey came from that he fed them? Option number one, perhaps the parents might have had scruples because the honey came out of a legally unclean carcass. Of course, dead animals were unclean under the Levitical law. That was a no-brainer. And Samson doesn't care about the law, but he's worried that his parents might, so he says, well, I'll give them some honey, but they won't eat it if they know where it came from, so I just won't tell them. Well, that's reasonable, but I really think that probably the real reason he didn't tell his parents is because he's thinking, how can I make a riddle out of this for the festivities at the wedding feast when everybody's feasting and telling riddles, I think was probably a typical type of entertainment at these wedding feasts, and so he wanted to keep it quiet so his parents wouldn't spill the beans and ruin his riddle. Verse 10, it says, after his father went down to the woman to get her, Samson made a feast there, for the young men customarily did this. There is in Timnah. The young men customarily did that in Timnah. John Gill says that another instance is we learn that the father of the bridegroom used to make the feast, not the friends of the bride, but at any rate, must have been the custom there. The young Philistine men made a feast. And of course, they're in a better position to do that. It's their hometown. Samson's father is not in his hometown. And that's another question. Why, since she's marrying Samson, why did they have the wedding back in Zorah or Eshtaol? Like the Chinese proverb says, Jiaji Suiji, marry the chicken, follow the chicken. The wife usually, the trailing spouse, as they say in human resources, the trailing spouse usually follows the man in ancient Near Eastern culture. So, but Samson, I guess in the wedding negotiations, the father of the woman from Timnah said, no, we're going to have the wedding here. We're not going to have it over there in Hebrew territory. So then the Philistine friends of the bride saw Samson preparing the feast, and then they brought 30 companions to be with him in verse 11. These would probably be friends of the bridegroom. Usually those are from your hometown, but they're in Philistia. So I suspect that they were just friends of the bridegroom, kind of substitute friends of the bridegroom. They probably just wanted to party. They saw Samson's feast. They said, let's have a good time. Now Josephus, the famous Josephus, he speculates the Philistines wanted to keep an eye on Samson. That's why they brought those 30 people there. James Fawcett Brown agrees with Josephus. But other people say this is unlikely because Samson has done nothing suspicious so far. They probably just wanted to go there and have a good time. So in verse 12, Samson proposes his riddle to the companion. He says, I give you 7 days. That's how long marriage feast lasted back then. I give you 7 days. If before the feast is over, you can tell me this riddle. I will give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. Now, a wrap changes of clothes is not exactly clear. In fact, other translations show that it's not clear exactly what they are. John Gill says the wraps are sheets or they're linen pajamas, whereas the change of clothes would be outer garments. It's absolutely impossible to know exactly what was involved, but we can know that we'll see that they were worth a lot of money, enough money that people would want to kill for those 30 changes of clothes and those 30 linen wraps. And of course, there's one for each companion. One linen wrap and one change of clothes for each of the 30 companions. How do we know, by the way, incidental detail, that 7 days was the normal time for a wedding feast? We can read in Genesis 29, verse 27. This is Laban speaking to Jacob, who's trying to get Rachel his wife. Jacob has been hoodooed, and Leah, he finds that he wakes up on his morning after he gets married, and there's Leah instead of Rachel. And so Laban, the father of Leah and Rachel, says this, complete this week of wedding celebration, and we will also give you this younger one, Rachel, in return for working another 7 years. So that was a week, 7 days of wedding celebration. We go now to Judges 14, verses 14 through 17. So he, that Samson, said to them, to the 30 companions, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now out of the eater, of course, that's the lion, came something to eat, that's honey. And out of the strong, that's the lion, came something sweet, is honey. So the answer is lion honey, lion honey. But they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. Then it came about on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband so that he will tell us the riddle, or we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us to impoverish us? Is this not so? Samson's wife wept before Samson and said, you only hate me, and you do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me. And he, Samson, said to her, to his wife, behold, I have not told it to my father or mother, so should I tell you? However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him so hard. She then told the riddle to the sons of her people. All right, let's think about this riddle a little bit. It's scarcely a fair riddle, some have said. If you think about it, when you ask a riddle to someone, the answer is generally within the hearer's range of experience. For example, if I say, what is black and white and red all over? Back in the days of newspapers, everybody had read a newspaper. Everybody knew what that was. So that's a fair riddle. But, so the argument goes, nobody had ever seen a bunch of bees and a lion skeleton. And so Samson is asking these 30 companions to guess a riddle by pulling something out of the air of which they had no experience. And so it wasn't fair. Well, if that's true, then Samson's a trickster in addition to all of his other vices. I don't know. I think it was fair. I mean, after all, Samson's putting up a big bet here. Those 30 pieces of linen and clothes were worth a whole ton of money, and so he knew the riddle had to be difficult. So I don't think it was unfair. It was just hard. And besides, you could say that those agricultural people back then might have seen this before, might have seen bees resting in the carcass of a dead animal. I don't know if it was unfair, but we do know it was difficult, and they never would have guessed it, not in a million years. Now we have a little problem with the fourth day. Came on the fourth day, the 30 companions said to Samson's wife, "Entice him. Tell us. Find out what the riddle means." Now we have a problem with the fourth day, because if we go down to verse 17, we read this, "However she, the wife, wept before him, before Samson, 7 days while their feast lasted." Well, now, if she's told the riddle on the fourth day, how can she weep for 7 days? Because there's only 3 days left in the feast. Well, there are three ways to answer that, three options. The first is my option. Maybe it's somewhere else, but this is my, it's not the best solution, but it's a solution I came up with. It could be that Samson told the 30 companions the riddle 4 days before the feast got started. So when the fourth day got there, it was the first day of the feast. The wife entices Samson on the first day of the feast, and she cries for 7 days during the feast. I think that's perfectly reasonable. But here's option number two. Could be how you translate it. John Gill says that she cried for the rest of the 7 days that were remaining in the feast, not for the whole 7 days. And so it would read like this. She wept before Samson while the feast lasted 7 days. In other words, instead of reading it in verse 17 like the NASB, "However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted," you read it like this. She wept before him while their feast, which lasted 7 days, was going on. Third option. She tried from day one to get him to tell her, day one of the feast. Her feminine curiosity impelled her for the first 3 days. What's the answer, Samson? And then on day four of the feast, the brothers' pleadings kicked in, and they said, "Entice him." And so now, for the last 3 days of the feast, or four, five, six, I guess that's three and a half days, 4, 5, 6, and 7, her brothers' pleadings are added to her curiosity, and so now she really wants to know what the riddle is. But she's been pleading with him the whole 7 days. She was just enjoined by her brothers to entice Samson on day four of the feast. I think that's the best answer. Now, notice the extreme reaction that these companions had. They told the wife, "You either find out what that riddle is by enticing him, or we're going to burn you and your father's house with fire." Whoa, that's sort of nasty. Why were they so extreme about it? Well, the next phrase tells us why. "Have you invited us to impoverish us? You've invited us to the wedding so that we are going to lose this big bet." Now, that's stupid to blame the wife on that. They took the bet voluntarily. It was their fault they took a bet. Think they could answer a riddle they can't answer. But at any rate, the word impoverished tells us why they're so upset and are threatening to burn the wife's house down and her father's house down. Impoverished, because if they lose that bet, those linen changes of garments and linen wraps were very, very expensive. Now notice, there's 30 of them, so each of them would only have to provide one change of garment and one linen wrap, just one. If Samson lost, he had to come up with 30. But he was so certain he wasn't going to lose. He didn't have that kind of money. But he wasn't worried because he knew he wasn't going to lose. That's another object lesson. Don't ever gamble on something because you might lose. Don't gamble. It's stupid. Now, in verse 16, Samson's wife wept before Samson. And is there any weapon more formidable than a woman's tears? Samson's just gotten married. He wants to please his wife. And here she is crying like a baby. He appeals to his parents. "I didn't tell my parents. What should I tell you?" She cries and cries and cries. Finally, Samson can't stand anymore, and he tells her. Another object lesson. If your wife is asking you to do something stupid, and she's appealing to your emotions by showing her your emotions, don't do it. Tell her, "No, sweetie, we're not going to do it, because there will be bad results if we do." And if she gives you the silent treatment, or she starts crying and moaning and wailing more, just steel yourself and say, "We're not going to do it." Now the Philistine wife said, "You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people." My people, the Philistines. This shows that you don't just marry the wife, you marry her people also. Another major principle, chief principle of marriage counseling, is you better like the family that you're marrying yourself into, or you're going to make yourself miserable, because your wife is always going to be somebody's daddy's little girl. So basically what that Philistine wife was saying, you hurt these 30 Philistine companions that were given to you that came to your party. They're my brethren, so you hurt them, you hurt me. And of course, Samson doesn't want to hurt his wife. She says, I care for these guys. If you care for me, you'll care for them too. Tell me what the riddle is. Now, of course, she wasn't that obvious about it. If she'd have said that, Samson never would have told her, but that's what she's thinking. We go now to Judges 14, verses 18 through 20, and we will finish this chapter. So the men of the city said to Samson, that's the city of Timnah, the 30 companions, they said to him, on the seventh day before the sun went down, that was the deadline for the riddle, and that's why it mentions the sun went down before that, because once the sun went down, riddle's over, Samson collects his 30, or his 60 actually, 30 wraps and 30 changes of garment. And so the men of the city give the answer. What is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion? They gave it in reverse order, but the answer, if you recall, was lion and honey. Out of the eater came something to eat. The eater is the lion. Something to eat is honey. Out of the strong came something sweet. The strong is the lion, and the something sweet is the honey. And then Samson answers. Samson said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. His heifer, of course, is his wife. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of them and took their spoil and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle. Samson didn't have money to pay off that bet, so he says, okay, I'll pay you off. I'm going to kill 30 of you Philistines. Take their clothes and give them to you. And his anger burned, obviously, and he went up to his father's house. In other words, he left Timnah and went back to Zorah, or Eshtal, wherever he was living, 5 or 6 miles back east. Verse 20, but Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. That's probably the friend of the bridegroom, the best man, as we say. So Samson's wife was taken away from him. If the Philistines have 30 of their members executed, killed, they're not going to want one of their daughters to marry the person who did the killing. Now, this plow with my heifer, I think, just means that you use my wife to find the answer to the riddle. But some people say that he's accusing the companions, or at least some of the companions, of committing adultery with his wife. Adam Clark thinks that. Must have a dirty mind. I don't think that. John Gill doesn't think that. No. They used his wife. And it's a good analogy because a heifer is young, a wanton. He's unaccustomed to the yoke. He wanders where he wants to go, does what he wants. Well, Samson's wife, she wasn't accustomed to the yoke of marriage. She sure dishonored her husband. Another good marriage. This would be a great chapter for marriage advice. The wife did not place her husband first. That's a great way to start off a marriage, isn't it? Now, verse 19 presents us with an ethical problem. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson mightily as he went down and murdered 30 innocent people. So how can you say that Samson is moved by the Spirit of the Lord as he goes out murdering 30 innocent people? Well, the easiest way to answer that, in my opinion, is to say that God is not sanctioning the means. He's just sanctioning the ends. He wants to destroy the Philistines. He uses the sinful actions of people to do it like he always does, as I've said over and over again. Here's what John Gill says, quote, Samson was now raised up of God to be judge of Israel, and that he acted now as such and under the direction and impulse of the Spirit of God, and the persons he slew were the common enemies of Israel, and if now observing a festival in honor of their gods, they were justly cut off for their idolatry. Well, that's an assumption Gill makes, that he killed them while they were doing some idol worship. We don't know that. But again, God gave Samson the Spirit to wipe out God's enemies, the Philistines, who were not nice people. These 30 that Samson killed were at Ashkelon, which is the famous Philistine city on the coast of the Mediterranean. I always remember Ashkelon because on a tour of the Negev, we were right down near Eilat, which is the very southern tip of Israel on the Gulf of Aqaba. And we saw, right before we got there, saw these big chain-link fences around these big installations, big pump-out block houses, and I was curious as to what that was, and he says, oh, that's the fans to keep the oil cool. I said, what oil? He says, the oil is coming up here from the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba. It's transshipped through the pipelines, through the hot burning desert, until it gets to Ashkelon on the Mediterranean coast of Israel, and then from there it's shipped to Britain and France and Germany, shipped to Europe. So Ashkelon is still there. Now in verse 19, the text says that Samson gave the changes of clothes to the 30 companions who answered the riddle. Doesn't mention the wraps, the 30 wraps. I'm assuming that they're there by implication. Some people say, nah, he didn't pay those to the 30 friends because they cheated to get the answer, so he just halfway fulfilled the bet. Nah, if he was worried about him cheating, he just wouldn't have paid the bet off at all. I think he thought that killing 30 Philistines was a much more appropriate response to being cheated than just reneging on paying the bet off. Or it could be he was thinking technically. I'm going to technically pay off this bet. I'm not going to let anybody say that I violated my word. As a matter of honor, I kept my word. I suspect that's what it really is. Verse 19 said that Samson had anger that burned. His anger burned. Well, he was probably mad at his wife just about as much as he was mad at the Philistines in general. Doesn't say that, but I suspect that's a reasonable speculation. He left his wife. He goes up to his father's house. Again, that's back at Eshtaol or Zorah. But Samson's wife was given away by her father to Samson's companion, who had been his friend, the best man at the wedding. And we can assume that this is with the woman of Timnah's consent, Samson's ex-wife. Probably the father said, "Honey, your husband just murdered 30 Philistines. I think we need to find another husband for you." And of course, there's no way to enforce the divorce. To stop the divorce, there's no legal proceedings. These are two opposing nations, really. And so that's the end of Samson's first marriage. And so we will stop here on this sad occasion and note that in our next audio, Judges 15, covering Judges 15, 1 through 20, we're going to see Samson defeating the Philistines, the 30 Ashkelonite Philistines who were killed. That's just a down payment. There's more trouble coming for the Philistines from the judge Samson. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.